Hey everybody, so first of all, straight up top, I recorded this episode with my three-year-old in the room, and so you may hear some random kitty noises or other talks about Puffin Rock or something like that right in the middle, and I tried to cut out as much as I could, but there's definitely still some in there, so if you're wondering what in the heck is going on, that is what is going on. And this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at Fisheries Pod or on Facebook and Instagram at Fisheries Podcast, or support the podcast on patreon.com/fisheriespodcast. If you're interested in showing off your support for the show or even a favorite fish species, please go check out our merch over at the Fisheries Podcast fan shop hosted by Teespring, where you can find t-shirts, hats, stickers, and more. Look for the link in the show descriptions. This week, our guest is Dr. Angela Collins. Angela is currently a Florida Sea Grant Extension agent serving Manatee and Sarasota counties in Florida. She holds a bachelor's degree in marine biology from Florida Atlantic University. She got both her master's and PhD at the University of South Florida in the biology department. She's studied numerous aspects of Florida marine fisheries and fish throughout her career, including stingrays, goliath grouper, hogfish, and more. She's a paddy dive master, avid angler, and amazing outdoors woman. She's also a friend of mine, but I really wanted to have her on the show because her path has been so varied and her work has been so unique that I wanted to give her a chance to share that path with everybody. So welcome to the podcast, Angela. I'm really excited to talk to you about your journey.
I'm really excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I love having conversations with amazing friends. I love to get to share them with people. So your current job is as a Florida Sea Grant Extension agent. Can you describe a little bit of what that job entails? I don't think that most people really have any idea what that means because I am your friend and I know that I don't.
I know. I didn't know what it meant either. And I think I'm still figuring it out every day, which is actually some of the best part about this job is we have a lot of flexibility in how we do our work and where we do our work. But in general, the Sea Grant Extension agent's role is to work with marine related stakeholders in the area that they serve to help with the conservation and sustainability of our marine resources and also improve the economic viability of communities that depend upon those marine resources. So the Sea Grant motto is science serving Florida's coast. And part of the part of our job is to help connect some of the most important stakeholders with the research that helps influence the conservation and sustainability of those resources. So I work specifically with our commercial and recreational fisheries. I'm based in the Tampa Bay area. So I kind of cover like that Hillsborough, Manatee, Sarasota County area on the southwest coast of Florida. And my primary specialty is in fisheries. So a lot of my energy is devoted to working with anglers on both the recreational and commercial side of things, and also working with our seafood producers, including our commercial shellfish growers. So that's kind of been a new thing for me since I started in this position. Is before I was just fish, 100% fish all the time. All I thought about was teleosts pretty much for the last 10 years. And then in this position, I get to still think about fish, but I also get to think about the broader spectrum of seafood that we provide in Florida. And so I've learned a lot about shellfish aquaculture, so clams and oysters and other bivalves that are produced here in Florida.
That seems like a pretty new industry here in the Tampa Bay area as well. Is it something that's really been increasing?
Yes. Yeah, it definitely has a lot of potential. Historically, it's been centered in the Big Bend region of Florida up near Cedar Key. That's where most of the shellfish aquaculture production happens in Florida. But there we have this great estuary, the Tampa Bay Estuary, and also Charlotte Harbor Estuary and Sarasota Bay. But Tampa Bay and Charlotte Harbor are where we have some shellfish production companies that continue to have the opportunity to expand.
That mission is just enormous. I don't even know how you could tackle it. And it just seems like you are constantly doing something different, like every day.
Yes, that's true. I'm never bored. That's one
So
of the biggest challenges too, but that's just part of it.
what are some specific projects you've been working on recently?
A couple of different things. One of the things that we have been working with is tagging gag grouper inside of Tampa Bay. We started that actually, it kind of was a continuation of work that I was doing from my time with FWC. One of the questions we wanted to ask, in addition to like survival after catch and release and regulatory discards for groupers, was also kind of their movement patterns within the estuaries before they move offshore. So we've been working with some of our recreational charter captains here in the region to tag groupers. We've gotten some really neat recapture reports that have kind of informed us on some of the movement and just sort of supplement some of the acoustic telemetry work that we'd previously done on gag grouper to.
Just to ask you about that. So you're doing conventional tagging?
With the charter guys,
Okay.
yeah, and that project's actually kind of at its terminus. We've kind of got, we've gone through the funding, and those guys are pretty much done with that project. But I know that FWC is continuing some work inside of Tampa Bay with some of the same captains, which is great. And they have some acoustic receivers going in. That's not my project, but it is definitely going to be happening in our area, which is exciting.
Yeah, for sure. That's really, really important and really cool. I was just on the East Coast Red Snapper CDAR the other week, and one of the biggest things that is still just a huge question mark in those stock assessment processes is catch and release mortality within the commercial fishery. And we were trying to just brainstorm how you could possibly get at that question. It seems
A
tough.
multifaceted approach. Yeah, for sure. It's one of those wicked problems, right?
Like we're getting a relatively good handle now on catch and release mortality, I think, within the recreational fishery for a lot of these species. The commercial fishery is still just like, I don't know, something. Maybe around the same, maybe less, maybe more. I don't know. And they do the best they can, but
Yeah, it's definitely a big task for all of our fisheries managers. There's so much data that has to go into these assessments, and all the species behave differently. And sometimes even within a species, it depends on the gear that you're using, the region that you're fishing, the behavior of the angler. All of those things go into whether or not that fish survives that catch and release event. So yeah, lots of questions out there to be answered, which is great, right? There's lots of research to do.
there's definitely no shortage of questions to answer. What do you think is the most exciting thing to you about your current job?
One of my favorite parts, I love science for sure, and I love the like pure research for research sake, but I also really like being able to translate how the research that we do or that other people are doing now benefits the stakeholders that really depend upon those resources, right? So I love talking to fishermen. I think that honestly, they know more about the resource than so many scientists do, because they're like they live it, they feel it, they have their hearts and souls invested in the resource. So I really, really love the ability to be able to share whatever I can with them and also learn from them to help design or implement new research questions for other researchers, or just helping move that forward is one of my favorite things. So I love talking to stakeholders. That's
And it does seem like that aspect has gotten more attention in recent years. Again, I was just on this the CDAR process, the stock assessment process for East Coast Red Snapper, and there's only a couple of industry representatives, but definitely, they asked their opinion about various different aspects of it. Like, what do you think that this number that we've came up with is relatively reasonable? What do you think? And I was really impressed that that was, really a main part of the process was really to get their input and have them, because it's so important. I mean, you're right. Like, these people are using this every single day. We're doing this work for them. We need And they're out there more than we are. So it's
Yeah.
just so important
for them to be and feel invested in the process.
Right, right. And to trust the process, you know, and if they're actively engaged in the process, they're able to trust it in a bigger way than they would if they weren't engaged. So yeah, I do agree with you completely there.
Absolutely.
And then the other wonderful thing about this job, and this is more on the personal side of things, but I'm reminded as I watch you with your background there, is that, you know, I'm not on the boat all the time anymore. You know, I'm not having those 16 to 18 hour days. And I still have really long days, don't get me wrong. But, you know, I'm a mom now. So having the ability to do what I love to do, but also have like this, spend more dedicated time as a mom is really important to me too. So balancing the jobs is a great thing.
Recently asked me, I did a show recently and they were like, well, why did you choose the job that you did after your PhD? And I was like, honestly, because I didn't have to move and the hours are really flexible and I can do it around being a mom.
You know, one of our most important jobs.
Right. I mean, is it exactly what I would love to be out doing every single day? No, but you know, it does allow me the flexibility to do other things as well and still remain involved in a field that I really love.
Yeah, absolutely. And honestly, nothing is perfect all the time.
Right.
No matter how great it looks from the outside, you know.
imagine having to be out on a boat today. Burr.
Right. Yeah, I did a lot of that.
Yeah, offshore going diving today? No, thank you.
Yeah.
60 degrees out. So what got you involved in, or what got you interested in pursuing marine biology in the first place?
I don't know if I'm rare in this or not, but it's always been what I wanted to do. So when I was in high school, that
me too.
I wanted to be, like, I was one of those people, and I didn't want to do dolphins. I never wanted to do mammals, no offense to mammals, but I was always into, to reef fisheries. And, so yeah, my track has always been sort of in that marine bio path. And I think it probably came from just kind of where I grew up. I was born in Florida on Anna Maria Island, and I was on the water a lot as a little kid. And we didn't have a boat or anything, but we were just near the water a lot. And I just fell in love with the resources and with the fishermen, like the, you know, the places that they are. I love the smell of the dock and the bait and the, you know, all those things are like home to me. So not to like romanticize it or anything, but it's just sort of where I've always sort of been.
So I didn't grow up like that at all, but I've always sort of known that that was where I was going, or at least into marine biology, because, you know, as a kid from the Midwest, like the dolphins were the things that I knew. And that got me in. I always say that they're the gateway animal to people getting interested. But once I landed in fisheries,
dolphins and turtles.
Yeah. Once I landed in fisheries though, there's no turning back. You know, I found out that studying dolphins was just as boring as studying anything else. You're just collecting data. But when I found fisheries, you know, and I realized that there was a way to collect data and also have it like mean something almost right away. So throughout your career, you have studied a lot of different cool fish, and I would consider them some of the most charismatic fishes out there. Can you tell me more about studying Kaunos rays?
Yeah. I haven't talked about Kaunos for a while.
I know, Kaunos, but they're so cute.
Yeah. They're amazing. They're little flat sharks. Yeah. They are, and they are charismatic. You're right. They're the most commonly touched stingray, I'm sure, because they're in touch tanks all over the place. I did my master's thesis. I got a assistantship with Moat Marine Labs. So I actually worked at Moat Marine Lab while I did my master's degree. We were looking at, my advisor was Dr. Michelle Heipel, and Dr. Phil Moda at USF, and Michelle was at Moat, and we were looking at Kaunos ray movement ecology and feeding behaviors in a Southwest Florida estuary, Charlotte Harbor. So that was my first experience with acoustic telemetry. We tagged Kaunos rays and followed them around basically with passive acoustic monitoring. We had a bunch of, Michelle, for part of some of her shark work, she had a bunch of acoustic receivers already deployed in Charlotte Harbor. So we tagged a bunch of Kaunos rays and basically looked at the areas that they spent most of their time within the estuary to try to identify whether they were spending a lot of time over seagrass or hard bottom or mud, you know, to just sort of identify where they were most of the time. And then also to look at their use of the Caloosahatchee River. So we were able to look at really interesting patterns with freshwater discharges, you know, because Caloosahatchee basically is the gateway from Lake Okeechobee to the Gulf of Mexico. So depending on different times of the year and what the freshwater flows were doing within the river, we could actually watch how the Kaunos rays responded to the salinity regime within the Caloosahatchee. So that was really cool. Salinity and probably flow. Yeah, that was a while ago. That was like almost 20 years ago.
I know, but everybody always talks about the hogfish and the Goliath grouper. I mean, they're cool and everything, but you know, starting off in Kaunos rays, that's pretty awesome.
Well, thanks. Thanks for remembering them and for giving them a shout out. I also had to do feeding because I had to have a feeding component to my work. So that was probably one of my most painful projects was identifying the stomach contents of Kaunos rays, which are basically smashers of all things. So everything they ate was obliterated into 1,000 pieces inside of their stomachs. And that was a fun experience as a grad student, was sorting through Kaunos ray stuff.
After that, built, I don't know, in my mind, humongous programs of volunteer spear fishermen to help you research both hogfish and Goliath grouper. Can you tell me more about how you sort of recruited people into those programs?
Well, so yeah, it was actually like right when I got done with my master's, Rich McBride hired me at FWC, and he had gotten some funding for this hogfish project, and he basically built this research proposal to, you know, kind of get a better handle on what was going on with hogfish in the Gulf of Mexico. And at that time, you know, the primary stakeholder group that harvested hogfish were spear fishermen. They don't, you know, hogfish, although you can catch them on hook and line, and people are definitely figuring it out, especially over the past few years. You know, historically, the main folks targeting hogfish were divers, and they were mostly taken by spear. So we worked with the St. Pete Underwater Club, which is the oldest, I think, standing dive club in the state, or maybe even the U.S. I don't know. They've been around since the early 50s, or maybe even, I don't know, a long time. They've been around a long time. And so we worked with that club, and they were amazing. I went on their boats for years to just go out and sample all of the hogfish that they were harvesting anyway, to get a better handle on, you know, what was going on in some of the life history characteristics on the West Florida shelf for hogfish. So over the course of a few years, we did tons of dives, sampled lots of hogfish, and this was all, you know, these guys basically, they got compensated for the trip, but you know, it wasn't a huge amount of money, but they were very invested in the resource and seeing the science improve for that species. And so that was probably one of my favorite things that I did, was working with that group. And then after the hogfish project ended, you know, we kind of built on this collaboration we'd already had going, and we wrote a couple of research proposals to get funding to look in closer detail what was going on with Goliath grouper. And so that's where we got like another several years of funding from NOAA to do Goliath grouper monitoring and tagging and that kind of thing, which I also turned into my PhD dissertation, like a combination of those things with some other questions involved too. But I'd take any of those guys' dive boats over a research dive boat any day, you know?
I think I remember too that they were pretty excited to be tagging the Goliath grouper because they got to shoot them.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and yeah, you want spear fishermen to do the tagging if you're doing tagging underwater, because you want somebody with really good aim. But yeah, they did get to shoot tags into them at the beginning. And then we started doing the acoustic work. And so then we were using more of the rod and reel guys to help us catch them and bring them on board and do some of that workup stuff that we were doing when we were, you know, tagging them and following them with the acoustic telemetry. So, but both methods of tagging were really exciting, and I think gave us some some good data.
Yeah, I can't even, I don't know, like handling a Goliath grouper on the deck to implant a tag and all that kind of stuff. It just sounds pretty intimidating to me. I don't know. I mean, I did some of your survey work with you underwater, and I was always a little intimidated by the Goliath grouper, and you were always just like following them around. And, you know, I know they're sweethearts, but, you know, they're still big.
Well, yeah. I mean, you definitely have to follow them with respect, right?
Right.
You were, you, I don't think you should say you were intimidated. You're right there with me.
I don't know.
But you gotta get close to get them on video and get them measured and, you know, all of those things.
So, right.
Yeah. And actually, after the Goliath project, the St. Pete Underwater Club and the contacts that we made by working with them on the hogfish and the Goliath work built into the work that we did with Gag Grouper after the Goliath work was done. So just those relationships with the stakeholders can be so beneficial to your research objectives because they help you, and it's so efficient, and, you know, it's a lot of times a lot less expensive than it would be if you were trying to do all of that work without stakeholder involvement. So yeah, I scream the benefits of cooperative research as often as I can, just because it just makes sense on both sides.
I feel like, having done just a little bit of it, I feel like it has a lot of really good just benefits for the process overall. You know, we've talked a lot about how, you know, stakeholder involvement and stakeholder just trust in the process is built through, you know, having their voice heard and everything like that, and hearing about what kind of things are going on within the research. You know, I mean, I, having done a little bit of it, you know, every time that I step onto somebody's boat and tell them like what I'm looking at, they're like, wow, that's amazing. And, you know, it's so good to have that kind of crosstalk between people. So moving forward into a pretend future, if money were not an object, what's one study that you would love to pursue in the future?
One thing just that I've always, I think this needs to be done, somebody's got to do it, is looking at like some of the harem dynamics within hogfish. Because, you know, these guys are sex changers, sex changes socially mediated. They have these really fantastic harems. And there's been work for sure done on like harem structure and how removal of the male impacts the stability and reproductive capacity of the harem and things like that. But I think it would be really fascinating to do some like laboratory analyses of some of the things that might impact sex change. You know, like if you had a huge Aquarius type situation and you could have multiple harems and males and introduce, I don't know, I think some of the social dynamics that happen and some of these sex changing fishes and specifically hogfish would be really fascinating to check out if money was no object and time was no object.
I think I want to do the same thing with red grouper. That was what got me started in my PhD, was like, yes, what are they doing at those holes? What is going on? Why are they moving around? Yeah. What happens when somebody gets caught? What happens to the dynamics, you know? And those are, yeah, still open questions, yeah, within all those species.
So yeah, so fascinating. Just at the individual level, what's going on in these spaces with these fish, I think is just, is really, really riveting. But from like a manager and fisheries management side of things, you know, one of my big passion projects is simply better evaluation of reef fish regulatory discards. You know, so like survival after release of these regulatory discards in the recreational fisheries, specifically across like the, you know, West Florida shelf, just because that's home to me and where, you know, my heart is. But I think like having like a basin wide angler involvement sort of mission, where all of the species within the reef complex are included, and you can, you know, work with university and extension faculty from throughout the Gulf. I think that would be a really, really well received project. It would be really expensive and really hard to control, probably.
Looking backwards, do you have any advice for younger people who might want to start getting involved in this field?
My advice is always kind of the same thing, I guess. And it's just how I try to operate anyway. But, you know, if you love it, do it really well. Try really, really hard to do it really well. Don't give up. The ice sound like a bumper sticker right now, but I think really hard work is huge, and hard work for little pay or appreciation is also really huge in our field, I think. And just being able to like handle that with grace and acceptance is important. So, you know, like just loving the work for the work's sake, and read all the time. Cause it's so crazy how the literature continues. Like it's almost like incapacitating sometimes when you look at how many new papers are published every single day and how many of them you want to read. So trying to stay on top of it is impossible, but at the same time, just try to stay on top of it. Try to keep up to date on what's happening, at least on your projects that you love the most.
So if you were having a beer after a long day in the field or a long day of whatever, and you know, everybody's sitting around and chatting and everything like that, and it was kind of like coming up to like your turn to like, you know, tell a story or whatever, and you start that story with, "No shit, there I was." How does that story go?
Probably the one that I tell the most is the bull shark story, because is that what you mean? Mm-hmm. So, and this is, I don't know, I'm not scared of sharks. Everybody's always like, what are you scared of underwater? And I'm really not scared of much in the ocean. I am scared of alligators, but that's why I'm a marine biologist and not a freshwater biologist. But anyways, yeah, so I was at a wreck and we were looking for Goliath, and I was just free diving up and down like to make sure that our jug was on the right spot. I see this like barracuda swimming straight toward me, and I thought, well, that's really weird, because he was like really fast making a beeline right toward me, and then I realized that he was being chased by a shark, and it was a bull shark, and the bull shark and the cuda, I think, was coming up to use me as a structure or cover, or, you know, and so the barracuda ended up at the last second jumping out of the water and over my body. I was just laying flat on the surface, and the bull shark like literally came up like, and I could have grabbed his pec fins and hung on, like his back. I felt like the dermal denticles on my stomach, you know, that's how close he was. And then he turned, like he came up, the cuda like jumped out of the water over me. And I know that because the people on the boat were like, a barracuda just jumped over you, as I was like hustling back to the boat as fast as I could. So that was the only time that a little bit nervous, but it happened like in slow motion. The whole thing probably took place in like 3 seconds, but I can still visualize it in slow motion, just like I described it. And that is, out of all those thousands of hours underwater, that's the only time I've ever felt like a little worried about an animal.
That's so crazy. Yeah, I know. I like having dove with you several times. I always feel like I'm really the jumpy one, and you're just like super zen. Like I remember that time. This is a long time ago now.
The hammerhead.
We were at a safety stop at like 15 feet, and the bottom was like 95 or something, and we're just hanging out in the water. And I think it was kind of cold that day too. And like all of a sudden, this like hammerhead comes by, and it's circling us. It's like watching us and going around us. And I was flipping out. I was like, "Oh my God, we can't get the cover. We can't get up. We can't get down. We have still 2 minutes left on the safety stop. That's like, you know, required, because you've been at 95 feet. Like, what are we going to do?" And you're just like, "Doo, doo, 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 this is fine."
I have a picture that picture I have of you, of that.
Of my eyes are just like enormous. I mean, in the end, it was awesome, but in the moment, I was very worried, and you were like, "This is so cool."
I was so proud of you for not going up.
All scientists, and especially us fisheries scientists, are absolutely in love with our work, but we also have to be people in the world. What's one thing that you love to do outside of science?
Oh, you know, I love travel. And that's one of the things that's probably making me the saddest right now with the pandemic. I mean, besides my family is my number one priority. And then, you know, obviously work, and then, but travel, just going anywhere, seeing new cultures, new people, new places. I'm really missing that right now. So a lot of times on a break, like I love to Google Earth and just like travel around and look at places from satellite view. But yeah, probably that, and you know, cooking, eating. drinking, reading, you know, the usual. If I didn't include like diving and fishing and that kind of stuff, if we weren't talking about any of that.
I mean, I don't know. As long as it's not like you're not collecting data.
Yeah. Well, so I love to free dive. And that I think is really fun for me to just go down with nothing in my hands. It always feels weird to not have like a data sheet or like a camera or a mission or something. But it's kind of liberating too to just leave all that stuff on the boat and just get in the water with no gear and just your mask and snorkel and fins and be able to explore. And I really like, this is kind of geeky, but I really love to go back to the places that we visit all the time for research purposes, but go there for like just a fun day, just to check it out and see what everybody's doing without the obligation of trying to, you know, pay really close attention to one thing or another or be responsible for anything. I think that that's a really fun thing to do.
I think that's fantastic. And I totally agree. One of my fondest memories of working in California was that we got to snorkel the same places every single day, year in and year out for 2 years. And we got to see, you know, how everybody was changing and all the babies growing up and everything like that. It was so fun to be able to keep going back to the same places because you just notice more and more things every time.
Yeah. Yeah. There was this, you dove it with us. We called it ACJ Ledge. And I know that you've been there before, but it's just this ledge. And for a long time when we were doing the hogfish monitoring project, it was one of our sites in Goliath too. We would go back and visit it a lot, you know, and there was this porkfish there, just one. So I know it was the same one every single time.
I do remember
it
that.
Follow us the entire survey and then follow us back. Remember that?
Yeah, yep. We called him Porky. I remember the porkfish. Yeah.
And he was just a little, you know, they're a little north of their range up here. So it was funny. He's not there anymore. I think one of the cold snaps got him
removed.
But anyway, seeing some of those characters at the same spots is fun.
So you mentioned already that you, you know, you have a family, you're a parent. How do you think that being a parent has impacted your work as a fisheries biologist?
Oh, it's completely changed. Well, not completely changed, but it's definitely, I call myself a recovering workaholic right now. Because before he was born, I could work all the time if I wanted to. Like I literally could. I could work at home. I could work on the weekends. I wanted to do that because I wanted to get caught up or keep things going or whatever. But after my son was born, number one, you don't want to work all the time because you don't want to miss some of this really important stuff. But number two, sometimes it's just impossible. Like if you're at home and they're home with you, like you're not getting anything written. It's just not going to happen unless they go to sleep or, and then the naps go away and you just, that's it. There's no more break in the middle of the day. You just got to get up really early. The work-life balance, this is a struggle, I think, for most people that have children. And even if they don't, like just having a balance is hard for everybody. So making sure that you do those things that are important to you at a personal level and take breaks from work is important. No, it's easier said than done.
The tough part of the interview is over and it's on to my final questions. So we're going to start really easy with, what is your favorite fish?
Oh, that is not easy. That's like the hardest question ever. I like, for what reason, you know, like my favorite sex changer, my favorite behavior, my favorite tasting. So I don't know. To eat, I would say one of my favorite fishes to eat is triple tail. Mm. To watch underwater, I would just have to go with some of my, you know, I love, so it used to be the barred hamlet, but now I think I'm just going to have to go with hogfish because mola or ocean sunfish are really amazing, but I've never seen one in the wild, but I love to tell my mola joke that I learned on National Geographic like 10 years ago. Do you want to hear it?
Yeah, I do.
What did the mola say when the marine biologist asked him, "Why do you look so funny?"
I don't know. What did he say?
He said, "I thought I'd quit while I was ahead.
I still have mola eyeballs in my freezer.
I run that.
Someday, when I can get back in the lab, I can peel them apart."
It's crazy that they're so derived, right? Like, they're just so crazy.
My Next question is, what is your dream job or location?
I feel like I've sort of been doing my dream job for a while. For the past 15, 20 years, I think I've been really fortunate that way. But my probably like ultimate, like if I was retired, I would love to do just citizen science projects right here on the west coast of Florida, in the Gulf of Mexico, or, get volunteers to help collect data underwater. I think that would be a fun, just like, you know, retirement ambition. Or it would be awesome to have some sort of a, I think you and I have discussed this before, it would be really fun, I think, to teach families and people that were scared of diving how to dive and, mm-hmm. you know, how to enjoy it. But that's just about the goal of every dive shop on the planet anyway. So it's not very unique, but I think it would be fun to incorporate science and like into teaching diving. And
then finally, if there was one point or principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
To listen carefully to everyone, to have that open mind and to pay attention even when somebody might not be speaking clearly or very well spoken, to listen and try to get as much as you can out of any feedback that people want to give you. If everyone had that, I think we'd be in a better place as a world.
Angela, thank you so much for being a guest on the show, and I greatly appreciated chatting with you. If people want to connect with you online or learn more about your work, where could they find you?
My email is great. abcollins@ufl.edu. And I can send you all kind of links.
Thanks, everybody, for listening to this 99th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. If you would like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter @fishvecchio. The podcast is @fisheriespod, on Facebook @facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, and on Instagram. Or you can email us with an old-fashioned email, feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. And don't forget to head on over to our Patreon page or our Teespring store to support the podcast if you feel inclined. I'm Julie Vecchio. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, make space for a variety of voices.
Yes.
Yeah, Mama Fisheries.
I know you're gonna edit these, right? I think we should just roll with it.
Beginning.
Mama's the baby one.
Yeah, I'm not sure that they're gonna come out as separate tracks. So it might just have a little.
I